Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Paul Taylor, the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing this event. And tonight, we'll be continuing this deep exploration of the future of spiritual practice with tonight's special guest, integral philosopher Steve McIntosh. Terry Patton is the visionary behind this groundbreaking series and online community and our host tonight. Terry is a leading voice in the fields of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality, who coaches, challenges, supports, and connects evolutionaries all over the world. He is the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice. Welcome, Terry. We look forward to a great call tonight.
Thanks so much, Paul. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening. As you know, this series was conceived to be a forum in which we could really advance the evolution of consciousness and culture by deepening a public dialogue about this moment in history, seeing it from an evolutionary perspective and asking the question, how can our spiritual practice evolve? How is it already evolving? How can it newly evolve to help us rise to the challenges of our time? Which really involves creating a cultural context in which we can make a transition, a profound and unprecedented transition, to a sustainable human presence on our planet, one that isn't driven by our hardwired drives for dominance and reproduction and status, and instead somehow cooperation is able to compete with those hardwired drives. So we've had a series of adventuresome and probing and enlivening conversations in which we've talked about the spiritual, philosophical, cultural, and I would say, you might say, in the domains not just of being, of doing, but also of being. Tonight, I'm really delighted to be joined in conversation by Steve McIntosh in a dialogue entitled The Spiritual Teachings of Evolution. Steve is the author of a really wonderful book, which I highly recommend, Integral Consciousness and the Future of Evolution. He was an original member of Ken Wilber's Integral Institute, and he's a current member of the Evolutionary Leaders Group that was convened by Deepak Chopra. He was also an honors graduate of the University of Virginia Law School and the University of Southern California Business School, and for 15 years, he has worked, he was a founder and president of the international manufacturing company, Now and Zen. For many of you who, like me, have for years been waking up to the gentle chime of a Zen alarm clock instead of an irritating buzz, you can thank Steve. He's the inventor of that widely used device, and he's traveled extensively throughout the world, has had a variety of successful careers, including practicing law with one of America's biggest firms, working as a top executive with Celestial Seasonings Tea Company, and competing at an Olympic level as a bicycle racer. He has just completed his upcoming book, which is entitled Evolution's Purpose, an Integral Interpretation of the Scientific Story of Our Origins. And I've had the honor of reading an advanced manuscript, and it's a truly exciting and uplifting and important book. It'll probably be released late next year. Steve lives in Boulder, Colorado with his wife and two sons, and his website is stevemcintosh.com. Speaking personally, I want to say that one of the things I really love about Steve, he's a personal friend, and he stands with me in the intention of catalyzing a cultural renaissance, solidly in the tradition, but transcending the classical enlightenment and the catalytic work of America's founding fathers. He represents a very original, new, inspired, I think it's a very vital and youthful and profound voice in integral evolutionary philosophy. And he's a playful and daring thinker with whom I feel free to test the growing edges of the evolution of culture and consciousness. And I just have a good time. So it's a great delight to welcome you, Steve, as my guest.
Thank you very much, Terry, for that introduction. before we begin our conversation, let me just thank you personally for our close friendship. I mean, we've been friends now for a number of years, and I have to say that just having you as my close friend has really helped to kind of hold up my consciousness and increase my own courage as we, dare, as you say, to try to bring about evolution in our own time. And I just want to admire you for your strength. I mean, that's one of the qualities that that I really appreciate, not only your obvious spiritual strength and your mental strength, as demonstrated by this series, but also your physical strength. You're a really good athlete, and we've had some great adventures. We've been backpacking and mountain biking, and it's just I just want to salute you there and thank you for having this dialogue with me.
Well, that's quite a compliment coming from a guy I cannot ever keep up with. maybe we'll visit some of those topics later in this dialogue. Steve, I would like to ask you maybe to kick this off by offering in your own words something about the basic ideas in your new book, the idea of progress and purpose in evolution. There's an awful lot of people in the public, popular intellectual conversation, materialist scientists who deny the connection between cosmic evolution and biological evolution, and they deny the continuation of that process in the form of cultural evolution. So they deny that evolution is progressing, and they deny that it has directionality and that it's going somewhere, which is called teleology, for those of you who aren't familiar with that kind of technical philosophical term. And they deny that it has a kind of overarching purpose. Now, I think in your new book you argue really eloquently and in terms that it's hard for a rational person to dismiss for progress and purpose in evolution. And I think it would be great if you could briefly explain some of the most important arguments for that point.
Sure. Well, the first, we have to begin by defining what we mean by evolution. And in the book, I spend a whole chapter carefully defining it. In a nutshell, it's the unfolding of the universe, the becoming from what cosmologists and physicists tell us is the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago through the development of cosmological evolution, the appearance of life, the evolution of life, of course, biological evolution. And then the way we're defining evolution is as the evolution of consciousness and culture, psychosocial evolution, if you will, is a direct continuation. There's a continuity between the evolution of stars and planets and the evolution of life forms and the evolution of human civilization and consciousness itself. And what ties all of these diverse domains of development together and makes them all authentic forms of evolution is that they are linked by this structure of what's called emergence, right? Emergence has come to have a kind of a technical, scientific meaning. It's a branch of theoretical evolutionary science which studies this this process by which something more comes out of something less. And under the scientific interpretation known as strong emergence, these emergent novelties, these new systems, exert a kind of control over the systems out of which they arose. So the most obvious example is that life emerges out of the prebiotic realm of matter and energy. You know, life is nothing more than matter and energy in terms of its substance, but there's more to it. You can't completely reduce life to matter, no matter how hard you try, because life contains something that matter doesn't, and that is purpose. Life forms strive to survive and reproduce, and if they weren't striving and trying to survive and reproduce, even no matter how instinctually or apparently automatically some of the most primitive life forms may appear to be striving, this striving is nonetheless it's purposive in the way that it's spontaneous. The evolutionary scientist Stuart Kaufman, who's widely respected, has done quite a lot of work on detecting what it is about life that is truly emergent, you know, that can't be reduced. And the thing which he identifies is what he calls agency, or as Lynn Margulis puts it, life is matter that chooses. And it's this ability to choose that's arguably the most radically emergent thing in the universe. I mean, you know, purpose is in evolution because purpose is in life. And so when we come to understand evolution this way, as this emergent sequence, and when we look and see, for example, what makes the evolution of human consciousness and culture part of a process which is linked to the evolution of matter and the evolution of life, is that this chain of transcendence and inclusion, this sequence of emergence that builds on itself, continues in the realm, just like life emerges from matter and constitutes a transcendent and inclusive new level of universe development. So too does the emergence of self-conscious free will and the ability to evolve our consciousness beyond our biological limits represent an emergence of evolution that's as significant as the original emergence of life from matter. And so, you know, not only do we see this emergence of life from matter and the emergence of self-conscious mind from life, but we also see that each one of these three domains, matter, life, and what we might call mind, that each one of these levels is itself characterized by a series of emergences that build on each other and accumulate over time. Right, so you know, we have single-celled prokaryotes, and from those emerge sexually reproducing eukaryotes, and then we have vertebrates, and then we have reptiles, and then mammals, and people are pretty familiar with the sequence of evolution. And while the phylogenetic tree of life may appear to be a sprawling bush with no apparent trunk or obvious tip, when we look at the structure of emergence that we embody within our own bodies, right, this sequence of transcendence and inclusion is physically in our bodies, right? Our molecules transcend and include our atoms, and our cells transcend and include our molecules, and our organs transcend and include our cells, etc., up until our physical organism. But our consciousness transcends that as well. We're not just our bodies. We're not just animals. We represent a level of emergent evolution that proves that it's more than merely biological evolution by the fact we now have this global civilization that encompasses the Earth. And, you know, that's an irreversible, cosmically significant event in the evolutionary history of the universe. And it too has emerged through this series of transcendences and inclusion, right? We learn how to speak. We learn how to have language. We learn how to have agriculture. We learn how to have democracy. We learn, you know, spirituality. These evolutionary emergences are building upon themselves, and they've been building on themselves for millions of years. Billions, indeed, 13.7 billion, to be exact, give or take 150 million years or so. So the reason that evolution is purposeful, as I argue in my book, is it's not a pre-planned or externally controlled kind of purpose. I'm not arguing for intelligent design or direct supernatural intervention in the process. But what I am showing is that this sequence of emergence that has built upon itself has been aiming at value and achieving unfathomable quality, beauty and truth and goodness has been unfolding in evolution for its entire history. And any process that consistently aims at value and builds on itself has to be recognized as purposeful. You know, it doesn't necessarily imply a super calculating intellect or a theistic God. You know, plants have limited subjectivity, but they exhibit tenacious purpose in their growth. And so one can recognize the source of purpose in evolution as a creative principle, or one can recognize it as a loving creator. I mean, this concept of purposeful progressive evolution can be compatible with a wide variety of spiritual conceptions about what the ultimate nature of the universe is. But I'm arguing that this process of purposeful development, which demonstrates this rising flow of creativity, which navigates immense hyperspaces of possibility and which solves incredible problems and continuously transcends itself. You know, Whitehead is famous for saying that creativity is the ultimate matter of fact in the universe. And we begin to see this creativity in an unmistakable way in the products and the processes of evolution. And when we begin to recognize that the evolution of our own consciousness and our own culture is directly tied to this larger process, we can begin to recognize that as we strive to improve things, as we strive to make the world a better place and give our gift and improve ourselves and help others, that we're directly participating in this larger overarching evolutionary process. And part of the proof of the purposefulness is that we can feel the purpose of evolution within ourselves. We have a direct, phenomenological, experiential affirmation of it, because we can feel, for example, within ourselves, we can feel our biological urges, right? Our hunger, our fear, our sexual desires. These are all ancient purposes which we share with every life form, practically. But we can also feel that purpose quickens as our consciousness evolves, and our purposes move beyond our biological urges into purposes for spiritual growth, purposes for beauty, and purposes for greater truth and goodness. So we know what it's like to be evolution happening. We can feel evolution's purpose within ourselves, and this is part of the way we know that our purposes are its purposes, and that we are sitting atop this cosmic process, and indeed it is I would argue our duty to be agents of evolution and to try to make the world a better place, even as we strive to improve ourselves.
So this feeling of evolution happening in and as us is feeling our innate urges to self-actualize, to make a contribution, to help make the world a better place, that kind of, higher level of impulse that we might feel within ourselves, that's what evolution feels like?
Well, that's one way to describe it, definitely. I mean, there's more to it than simply getting in touch with our desires for improvement. But we can recognize that there is an eros, or a kind of a value gravity, which is extant within the universe. In other words, the existential, ontological quality of the universe has driven and drawn humans since their inception to try to improve their conditions, right? Trying to improve the human condition, both personally and universally, is a calling which many, many humans have felt, and it's by following this calling and trying to improve our conditions that we have achieved this new layer of evolution, this evolution of consciousness and culture wherein we have this evolving civilization. And, it's not a simple upward escalator to the good. I mean, there is a what's been well identified as a dialectic or a sort of polarity of progress and pathology. So as human culture and consciousness develop, with every new achievement and every new accomplishment, there arise new challenges and new problems that can only be solved by further evolution. So we see, that indeed humanity has made tremendous material progress in the last 350 years or so, but this has also brought tremendous threats and challenges and dire events in history. And so, we can definitely recognize that the shadow of our progress follows us with increasing pathology, but that brings with it a duty to try to continue to solve our problems and evolve further.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, having set that forth, another one of the core pillars of your work and everything that you've communicated, particularly your first book, is integral philosophy and the key ideas that are the anchors for it. And I think it would be helpful if you took just, a limited amount of time, but in a essential way, maybe a few of the key ideas that might convey the essence of integral philosophy.
Sure. Well, I'd say, you could probably reduce integral philosophy to two words, and that is consciousness evolves. Many of us in the progressive spiritual community kind of take this for granted, but this is not this isn't something that our larger society or, the mainstream of the developed world has really fully faced or even really digested. The fact that our consciousness evolves in ways that can transcend our biology, right? Before the advent of humans, animal consciousness, more or less, had to evolve, or animals had, in order for them to get smarter, they had to evolve biologically. But for humans to evolve their consciousness, to widen their perspective and to grasp new levels of insight about what's real and what's true and beautiful and good, we're able to evolve our consciousness in ways that don't depend on our biology. I mean, whatever evolution our brains may have gone through in the last 10,000 years can't by itself account for the tremendous evolution of consciousness that has taken place in at least some parts of the world. And for example, we've moved from our conception of morality is a good line that we can point to as a marker of evolution. You know, we've moved from egocentric morality, where those worthy of moral consideration are only those who are within our immediate family or tribe, to a more ethnocentric conception of morality, where those who deserve consideration are part of our religion, you know, or ethnic group. And now, as consciousness continues to evolve, we're grasping at larger levels of world-centric morality, where everybody, and indeed all sentient beings, deserve moral consideration and respect. And so the evolution of consciousness, understanding this, is really, I'd say, the central focus of integral philosophy. And integral philosophy uses a lot of models and ways of understanding this, but I think that, like all forms of truth, it's scalable in the sense that it can be reduced to two words, and you can expand on it further and further, and you can write a 2,000-page book on it. So to try to summarize its truths, I would say that consciousness evolves along many lines. It evolves through many stages of development, but we can recognize in the evolution of values a succession of worldview stages whereby human culture has emerged from its earliest stages, its earliest states, its earliest conditions. And it's through these successive dialectically related stages of values development that human civilization has largely evolved by. And when we come to see this internal structures, what I like to call an internal cultural ecosystem of values that provides the structure for the evolution of consciousness, this helps us recognize the dynamics of evolution. It helps us see a new depth and clarity into the internal elements, which are so crucial to understanding cultural evolution. You can't just understand it from a social science perspective, where you're looking at it from as a disinterested anthropologist or sociologist. And while, you know, the research of the social sciences and their insights is helpful, we certainly want to use those. I would say most integral philosophers would agree that there's a level of depth that can't be gotten at when you're in a supposedly objective scientific perspective, that you need to have a more hermeneutical or dialectical or interpretive understanding of nature and history that can help us see how consciousness is evolving. So integral philosophy is, we could trace it back to, say, maybe even Georg Hegel, but it really begins in the 20th century with the work of Henri Bergson. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin and Alfred North Whitehead are big figures within the development of this new spiritual understanding of evolution. Jean Gebser, Sri Aurobindo deserve mention. Of course, Ken Wilber has been significant in his furthering of evolutionary philosophy, spiritual evolutionary philosophy. So, I could go on, but how's that?
No, that's great. That's really helpful. And it kind of sets the stage for something else I wanted to press into a little more, because there's an idea that has kind of woven in and out of this series as it's progressed, which is the idea that one of the things that's happening now culturally is that there's an emergence and maybe a struggle to go beyond a postmodern cultural mode of being into an integral phase of culture. And some of our guests, like Ken Wilber and Andrew Cohen and Claire Zammit and Diane Hamilton, are strong advocates for the importance of critiquing postmodernism and emerging from it, whereas others, people with whom I've had fantastic conversations, including maybe Gagaji, Sadhguru Jaggi Vasudev, Rick Hansen, Dan Millman, they don't specifically critique postmodernism, and doesn't seem to be a part of the vocabulary they're oriented toward. They're emphasizing the importance of spiritual, or in some sense, common sense or scientific practice or morality or awakening or understandings. How important is this distinction between postmodern and integral streams in progressive spiritual culture? How do you see this? What's the difference between them, and what's the importance of growing beyond postmodern approaches to spirituality and culture?
Sure. Great question. First, let me confirm, for at least many are already familiar, that within the parlance of integral philosophy, the term postmodern is used to refer to a kind of a whole collection of perspectives which have emerged beyond mainstream modernism. And although this includes the environmental movement and includes progressive spirituality, it includes certain critical forms of academia. I mean, the word postmodern is a battleground of meaning. And it's used to refer to art movements or to, you know, deconstructionism or other more narrow uses. But we're using it as a defined term, and I'm careful to define it in both integral consciousness and in evolution's purpose, and to try to use it despite, you know, the fact that it has baggage and people can confuse it for what we mean. But the important thing to talk about first with respect to postmodernism is that from an integral perspective, we recognize what's been described as a vertical dimension of development. In other words, you know, development can occur on all kinds of we can recognize horizontal dimensions of development as things fill into different niches and move out. And the idea that some forms of consciousness are more evolved than others is certainly controversial, and not everyone accepts that. People might argue that people are people, and, you know, human nature is human nature. We're all Homo sapiens, and so that we're all equally evolved. But when we begin to analyze and understand the evolution of consciousness, we see that indeed there is a vertical dimension of development. And whether we have a stage theory to describe that, or whether we see this dimension of development as being more like a river with intermixed flows, we have to recognize that there is a structure of development. I mean, to paraphrase the famous developmental psychologist Jean Piaget, you know, he was famous for saying there is no structure, there is no development that lacks a structure. And so we see that consciousness and culture develop, that they do develop. And what integral philosophy can see is that this development, indeed, after Piaget, it has a structure. And from an integral perspective, this structure is not just a seamless continuum of growth. There are stages, and each stage is kind of dialectically separated. And by dialectical, I mean the simplification of that idea has been expressed with the idea of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. So every new stage is kind of pushing off against the problems of the stage that came before it and trying to achieve an improvement of the human condition that's partially defined by the failures of the existing civilization out of which that new evolutionary movement arises. So we see the stagnation of medieval society and the class-bound culture of feudalism. We see the modernist worldview, in another defined term. We see, but you know, it's more well accepted. Modernism emerged first during the Renaissance, and then came about more in the Enlightenment, and it brought about science and the Age of Reason. And modernism initially was pushing off against the pathologies and the limitations and the stagnation of the medieval Christian society out of which it arose. Likewise, we see that we have 350 years of modernism. You know, it succeeds in many ways. It brings us scientific medicine. It brings us technology. It brings us democracy. It brings us all the benefits of living in the developed world. And it also brings us environmental degradation, nuclear, you know, the threat of nuclear annihilation, exploitation. I mean, I'm sure everybody listening could come up with a long list of the pathologies of modernism. And so a worldview structure like the ones before it emerges and has been emerging for the last 50, well, really the last 200 years, but politically as a more of a demographic social structure, this postmodern worldview, we see it beginning emerging in the counterculture of the 60s and maturing in the 70s and really coming into fruition in the 90s as a major segment of culture within the developed world. It's been described by other names such as the cultural creative demographic or the green meme. But regardless of all the disparate and somewhat, you know, disconnected elements of what has emerged beyond modernism, one of the things that unites the postmodern worldview as a coherent evolutionary structure in history is that there's agreement regarding the abundant pathologies of modernism. Anti-modernism is one of the hallmarks of postmodern thinking, right? In other words, you recognize the problems of modernism are highlighted and the benefits are sort of taken for granted or discounted, right? The idea that the successes of modernism are prerequisite and ongoing for postmodern culture, despite, you know, the back to the land movement or, you know, attempts to become more simple. If modernism was to collapse or be completely wiped out, it wouldn't be long before there were only tiny pockets of postmodern culture left clinging to the world, like we saw, you know, the Irish monks trying to preserve, you know, learning and literacy during the Dark Ages. So let's hope that doesn't happen. I don't think it's inevitable or that it needs to. But postmodern thinking is what you and I grew up in. It's what gave us a spiritual orientation. It's what helped rescue us from materialism or careerism or thinking that, you know, our value is defined by our status or material. You know, so this postmodern worldview has really created a lot of progress, like all the worldviews before it, in terms of improving the human condition by making us more environmentally sensitive, by more pluralistic, by more sensitive to the people who've been exploited or taken advantage of, have been victimized by previous historical structures or movements. And so it's making us more moral, and it's bringing about a lot of beauty and truth in the process. However, like every worldview before it, not only has it brought great gifts and great progress, but this countercultural, postmodern, spiritual, progressive worldview has also brought pathologies. And one of those pathologies is that it's good at identifying these problems like climate change and the problems of the developed world. But it's not, hasn't, at least so far, been particularly effective at solving those problems. And that itself is a significant problem, which is animating the emergence of this next worldview, which can hopefully do what postmodernism has not been able to do, and that is integrate at a higher level all the stages of consciousness that have emerged through history. And so instead of being limited to one ideology or one worldview, the integral perspective can better recognize that every one of these stages has enduring values that we need to move forward. That the degree of our transcendence is ultimately measured by the scope of our inclusion. And if we want to transcend the current culture war and the current environmental crisis and the other problems that plague us, then we're gonna need more than postmodernism is currently offering in terms of in many dimensions. And one of those, of course, is having this new perspective on cultural evolution that can go beyond relativism, that can go beyond welcoming pluralism, and begin to reclaim a recognition of relative excellence, while at the same time being informed by the sensitive values that we've inherited from our, you know, postmodern foundations.
So that definition and this kind of setting forth, yes, we need to evolve beyond postmodernism. I'd kind of like to wade into that a little bit further. Let me offer some things here just kind of to deepen our discussion. One of the ways that I sometimes talk about the distinction between the postmodern mind and the modernist mind is that at a certain point we realize that where we stand, it determines what we can see, that the language we speak determines the questions that we can ask, and that there isn't absolute knowledge of an objective reality in quite the same way, and that is the bridge to a postmodern understanding. But as one comes into that awareness, the kind of awareness that immediately arises, oh, there are all these covert agendas in these claims for objectivity, and look at the classism and the racism and the sexism and the all kinds of covert agendas that are kind of being masked by this pretense of objectivity, and so there's this whole push in postmodernity to level the playing field, and you know, any woman who's got a really free, intelligent life, you know, is very appreciative of modernity's beginning the process, and postmodernity really kind of putting the cherry on the top of that. So just for her to even have a free life, and certainly anybody in a formerly colonized country or anybody who's been a victim of racism or sexism or prejudice against sexual orientation is appreciating modernism. But so we're all deeply founded in modernism, and yet we're all stuck. And one of the reasons that I think this conversation is so important is that culturally, we're in a world right now in which modernists and postmodernists and traditionalists and all kinds of people that are hybrids of those three in various ways, holding those values very, very powerfully, are locked in culture wars that are getting us nowhere. And postmodernists are not in a position to solve it at all. And the awareness that all of these are necessary and can't be eliminated, and that each of them holds a piece of the truth, and fierce commitment to break that deadlock and to move things forward. All of these are aspects of what I experience as my integral consciousness and my integral, you know, you might say, the mandate that comes with seeing a certain level of this pattern, seeing into this physics of the internal universe clearly enough that I'm no longer contained by a postmodern view, has been a big part of what's made it necessary and possible for me to feel that another step forward in our cultural evolution is possible, necessary, and even my personal responsibility. What would you say to that?
Well, first, I would agree. And then I would say that when we've come to understand, when we really frame our civilization in terms of this evolutionary dimension, and we recognize that it's an authentic form of evolution that has many similarities with similar kinds of evolution, we begin to see this pattern of transcendence and inclusion, right? This dialectical pattern of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, and how the synthetic emergence of higher levels of consciousness and culture, civilization, more evolved, more able to see larger perspectives of value, right? That's what makes it more evolved, is that there's more truth, more beauty, and more goodness, not just quantitatively, but qualitatively as well. When we recognize that that's possible, that we can achieve a more robust and complete understanding of what's true through this analysis of evolution, through evolution as a lens that we can cast on our own society and see it through this evolutionary perspective, we begin to see how these earlier stages are, their success is a prerequisite. You know, the higher development depends on the ongoing functionality and health of previous systems. But we can also see how previous systems contain what we might call evolutionary scaffolding, right? That elements of their structure, which was important for overcoming the level from which they emerged, from which they, the level that they transcended, in order to transcend that level, they had to kind of do battle with it to a degree, and that leaves this this scarring or this pathology, which was perhaps inevitable or maybe even useful at a previous time in history, but which now is holding us back. So, for example, when we look at the traditional worldview that many in progressive culture can usually only see, they're very threatened by conservative religious views. And there are threatening things about it. It's not an illusion. But there are also elements of that stage of cultural development that are indispensable. And if we are to completely dissolve the good parts of those previous developments, then the whole structure is going to collapse back. So in other words, values that we continue to need, like decency and honesty and personal responsibility, that arise with this traditional worldview, are, you know, remain connected to pathologies that we need to prune away, like racism and sexism and ethnocentric, aggressive foreign policy, but from a if you don't have an evolutionary perspective, it's often difficult to appreciate the difference or being able to tease apart these pathologies from these enduring values that we need to hold on to, right? So just like we can't get rid of a given evolutionary level in our own bodies without our bodies collapsing, we can't get rid of the enduring elements of these earlier stages of development. And so coming to see that with new eyes, beginning to recognize how something can be more evolved while also recognizing the relative value that's already there, is part of the new way of seeing what's called an evolutionary epistemology, or kind of a method of seeing things that can accommodate these conflicts, these apparent built-in problems. So, you know, when we look from a postmodern perspective at modernism, you know, we see the rigidity of the Newtonian, Cartesian, you know, mindset. We see the folly of materialism. We see, you know, greed, and we see capitalism's overreaching, and we see the horrors of globalization and the horrors of the 20th century. And we, you know, I mean, people of good sense and good faith can conclude that modernism is a mess and we'd be better off without it. But that perspective itself, that pluralistic relative perspective, it depends on the previous developments that have been achieved by modernism. It's only because we live in a prosperous, democratic, education-rich society that we begin to have those more evolved perspectives that recognize that purely vertical development by itself, without a compassionate inclusion of everyone, a more pluralistic understanding that that leads to pathology, right? It's this. The reason that evolution is so deeply dialectical, both in the way that it develops and in its basic structure, is I think that this is a pattern of evolution which is kind of a self-similar reflection of the larger structure of the universe as a whole. In other words, we can see that, you know, just as the finite universe of time and space emerges out of, you know, a previous state of the infinite, eternal, you know, pre-existing, pre-temporal universe, that dialectical tension of the thesis of existential perfection and this antithesis of the finite universe, that very big picture structure becomes embedded in every little element of development that we witness. And it's there like a fingerprint, you know, of the creator. And yet it's also a structure that provides an opportunity. You know, like this dialectical separation of the incomplete is like a portal or an opening through which we can pass. It gives us an opportunity to become agents of evolution ourselves. But I'm getting a little deep there. Let me come back to your question and say that I think that the postmodern perspective itself represents the evolution of consciousness and culture. And yet it hasn't achieved this evolutionary perspective which would allow it to better appreciate you know, not just those who've been marginalized and exploited, but also the achievements and the progress that have been afforded through earlier stages of development, and to be able to recognize those earlier stages not just for their pathologies, but also for their ongoing contribution, so that we can achieve a more harmonious, integrated whole. And that by itself can reduce the conflicts that kind of pin people in place, right? If we, you know, to get practical about it, if we want to see America's cultural center of gravity move forward in history, whereby our politics can become more progressive and we begin to overcome, you know, the logjam and the stalemate and begin to deal with our problems, you know, like renewable energy, et cetera, then part of the way we can do that is help make those who are resisting postmodern political programs less defensive. In other words, anything that's near and dear to the hearts of postmodernists, like environmental sustainability and, you know, alternative energy, because of the culture war, those on who are in the more conservative side of modernism or in the traditional worldview, because they feel their values are threatened by postmodernism in general, resist anything that seems to be postmodern because they're reflexively being defensive of their own identities, their own loyalties. And that's understandable because postmodernism does threaten some important enduring loyalties that are embodied within the traditional and modernist worldview. And through an evolutionary perspective, we can help to improve postmodernism so that postmodernism itself isn't so divisive and it can better achieve its mission of helping to have its perspectives more integrated into the larger, you know, mainstream of developed culture.
So in practical terms, it would mean helping postmodern culture to become more respectful of modernism and more respectful of traditional values and traditional people, such that postmodernists would this would maybe be a critique of the Bill Mayer style of progressive postmodernism, that is polarizing in and of itself, and that as we become less scornful as postmodern people at a postmodern or beyond level, if we're more deeply feeling the common values and concerns that are motivating traditionalist conservatives or materialist modernists, we're going to be able to find common cause with them and heal these cultural rifts. Is that the drift of it?
Yeah, I don't think that there are certainly many orthodox postmodernists, just like there are orthodox atheists and orthodox fundamentalists, who are never going to really move off of their position because their identity is too embedded in it, and they're upholding that structure in history, you know, in a dedicated way. But I think that there are many, especially within postmodernism, who are seeking their own personal growth and can hopefully recognize this evolutionary development as something that offers a way for them to, you know, if you'll pardon the cliche, become the change. And what that means is beginning to objectify their own worldview, to begin to step outside their value system and see it situated within history, and to see that indeed it made progress by pushing off against the problems of modernism, right? It is the rejection of the establishment and the embrace of a countercultural set of values was extremely liberating and offered one of the most potent ways to move forward, certainly in your lifetime and mine. And you know, that stance of antithesis, that militancy, served to help postmodernism grow. It served to help it achieve a kind of escape velocity from mainstream modernist culture and kind of stake out a new place, a new cultural location that was more elevated, had, you know, more spiritual, more evolved, more world-centric, more environmental, more, you know, more biocentric, you know, all kinds of measures by which we could perhaps agree that postmodernism did achieve evolution beyond modernism. And yet, postmodernism is not the end of history. You know, it's not as if, you know, that we can sort of rest there, because postmodernism has its own problems, one of which is the rejection of its own civilization, right? And so we can help postmodernism become more effective by showing its stance of antithesis and offering yet another further location within this trajectory of cultural evolution that provides more synthetic transitions, you know, that the thesis of modernism and the antithesis of postmodernism can be healed, reconciled, and partially harmonized, you know, without just smushing it all together. There's still conflict. There always will be. I mean, this river of development will always have dialectical bends and antithetical meanders. But the way that we can help, I think it's a strong argument that says that we can help bring more modernists and even traditionalists into our way of seeing, and we can help them adopt our values more readily. We can be a lot more persuasive from a stance of synthesis than we can from one of antithesis.
Okay. Well, that I think that's pretty clear. And now, you know, for those of us on the line who are less philosophically inclined, I'm sure that there's a desire to kind of bring this down into the place that I really anchored this whole series, which is that of a, you know, committed world citizen, spiritual beings who are awakening in various ways in our own hearts and minds and spirits in ways that are seeing the crisis of our time and the really big challenges that are before us. How can this translate down into direct activism? What can we do right now to cohere an integral evolutionary culture, a new level of spirituality, a dynamism that is actually going to create change in the world? What do you think the prospects and most important initiatives are along those lines?
Sure. Well, one way to reframe that question was, how can people participate and become active, you know, I call members, but sort of worldview structures, these organisms of history, if you will, consist of value agreements. They're like structures of value. And the way you participate primarily is you begin to see those values and agree with them. You know, you kind of make the agreement by reorienting your life in a way whereby these values come to become, you know, you sort of, your course is slightly corrected, because values are our aims, our goals. And when you adopt a new set of values, this changes the way you behave on practically every level. And it doesn't necessarily always have to be radical, right? There's subtle changes. I mean, you know, most people who are firmly committed to the evolutionary or integral worldview are still, some of them are very, you know, if you went to their houses or you got to know them, they would be indistinguishable from postmodernists in many ways, in terms of their dress or their tastes or, you know, who they hang out with. And yet, the emergence beyond this postmodern worldview into this evolutionary worldview comes out in lots of profound ways. But in order to really get a sense of it, the best way is to look at examples from history and say, how do people, for example, when modernism was first emerging in the European Enlightenment, I mean, regardless of ancient Greece or previous outbreaks of modernism, I mean, for our purposes, the modernism that we have inherited in the developed world arises within the Enlightenment. And during the Enlightenment, people were called to adopt a new scientific way of seeing things. And this wasn't just limited to, you know, aristocratic, educated elites. You know, for example, Tom Paine was, you know, the famous revolutionary in the United States. He was not an aristocrat, but he was definitely dissatisfied and politically aware, and he had read The Philosophers of the Enlightenment, and he was really kind of lit up by the possibilities of the modernist worldview, and he took it upon himself to write this pamphlet, Common Sense, which was a major catalyst for the American Revolution. You know, so guys like Tom Paine are examples of people who became uplifted by the emergence of a new worldview. They began to metabolize its values, its political perspectives, its truths, its new ideals of morality, and they took action based on these values to try to bring those values into being. And in the case of Tom Paine, he was, you know, spectacularly successful in the effect that he raised consciousness all over the Western world and brought about, you know, the revolution, which, I mean, not single-handedly, but, you know, he's a good example because he's not just Thomas Jefferson, who had every, you know, every privilege and was, you know, the recipient of this kind of aristocratic education, et cetera. But so we can see how people adopted modernism in the 18th century by metabolizing its values, by listening to its leaders, by reading its books, by participating in its institutions and organizations, and by becoming activists in ways that you know, were available to them to try to bring about change. Likewise, during the rise of postmodernism in the 60s and 70s, people adopted the postmodern worldview, and I mean, you know, the motto was, right, turn on, tune in, drop out, and many people did that literally, but not everybody became a hippie, and you didn't have to become a dropout to become a sort of adopt the postmodern worldview. But that meant that you, you know, your heroes and the people that you resonated with and the people that you wanted to be friends with and socialize with and you know, the groups that you wanted to participate in were animated by this emerging new value system, right? And when, especially in its emergent phase, the opportunities for otherwise, you know, unempowered individuals to participate in a meaningful way in that emergence, you know, are abounding, right? So now that the integral worldview is emerging, there's so many opportunities for people to make a difference, even if they don't have, you know, huge credentials or huge capital or you know, that they have to, you know, work or feed their kids. They can still be activists within the emerging evolutionary worldview by trying to further its aims, by communicating its values, and by living it as a truth. So, you know, every one of these worldviews emerges. It's like a new octave of value, like a new dimension of beauty, truth, and goodness, right? So with emerging modernism, we see the new truth of science. We see the new morality of democracy and a new way of, you know, organizing ourselves. We see the new beauty of, you know, like, for example, classical music and, you know, a more sophisticated form of art. Likewise, with postmodernism, new truth, new beauty, new goodness comes about, and it can be distinguished from modernism, even though, you know, there are some currents that include both. So now we have this new octave of value emerging with the evolutionary or integral worldview, and it presents a whole new possibility for valuing. It gives us the ability to recognize evolution itself more clearly and thus participate in it more directly.
Yeah. And I think that's a beautiful statement. I think I'd like to push it further forward just by kind of leaning in as a conversation partner more,
sure.
Maybe not just as an interviewer, and say that my sense is that we're at a time in which there is a real potential for a larger cultural pivot, and it requires a coherent group, a movement, a whole lot of people who are awake to the values of traditionalism, modernism, and postmodernism, but really are free of the governing sentimentalities that bind all those views. For instance, in the environmental zone, when people are just completely anxiety-ridden and overwhelmed with a kind of hand-wringing, oh no, it's all coming to an end kind of a mood, there's a self-disempowerment in that, and it's an aspect of one of the you might say the poles, one of the vortices within the postmodern disposition, and it doesn't help us be affirmative, positive agents in the larger cultural conversation. So coming into a kind of fundamental yes, as I spoke this in a recent blog post that some of the folks on the line have read, a kind of unconditional commitment to the further development of this grand evolutionary experiment, to being a midwife to an unknowably glorious future, and holding that with a kind of ferocity, it's got to do with a fundamental courage. I was delighted. A friend of mine pointed me to a very short essay by Immanuel Kant that he wrote right around the time of the founding of the United States, called, interestingly enough, "What is Enlightenment?" The same title that was used for Andrew Cohen's magazine some years back. And he identified kind of the call of enlightenment. He said, "Enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-imposed immaturity. And it's self-imposed when its cause lies not in a lack of understanding, but a lack of resolve and courage to use one's understanding without the guidance of others. Sapere aude," it's a Latin phrase meaning "dare to know." Have courage to use your own understanding. That's the motto of enlightenment. And he goes on, "If I have a book to serve as my understanding, a pastor to serve as my conscience, a physician to determine my diet for me, I need not exert myself at all. I need not think. If only I can pay, others will readily undertake the irksome work for me." And I think that in this day, something of that kind of spirit of, hey, let's wake up, is rising forth again. But instead of use your reason, I think that the mood of this moment of integral evolutionary enlightenment has to do with use your integrated head, heart, gut intelligence, your spiritual intelligence, and our collective intelligence, which really do transcend, although they absolutely include our sense of reason, and come together as a kind of new level of responsibility for this world, this evolutionary planet, this evolutionary process, this beautiful planet, the whole shebang, and let's become a more cohesive cultural force together. Let's support each other in our individual evolution, and let's become participants in this larger play of culture war and division in a way that is a healing force and an uplifting force that changes the game. And the sense that we have an obligation to do that, and that it takes courage, you know, dare to know, dare to see for yourself what's really going on here, and what does it call forth from me? What is going on here? I think something of that is the spirit. It's certainly the spirit, I think, of a lot of our dialogues. How does this strike you, and how would you rejoin me there?
Sure. Well, first of all, I would give a hearty affirmation to Kant and to your framing. Let me go back to this notion of imminent collapse. Right? I mean, it's tied to a similar kind of a notion that there's going to be a worldwide spiritual renaissance, you know, a great awakening, just like television's turning on all over the planet, and people will come to a kind of a world-centric, environmentally sensitive conception somehow miraculously, you know, in some great emergence. And I think both of those ideas are, within postmodern culture, pushed to their extremes. In other words, I'm certainly very concerned about climate change and global warming and environmental degradation, you know, generally. But the idea that that in the next 3 years or the next 10 years, modernism itself is going to completely collapse and we're going to be back to, you know, kind of a new dark age, I think there are a lot of people within postmodernism, because of their deep anti-modern sentiments, for whom they kind of relish that prospect sort of secretly. And so the real threat of global warming is kind of in some ways hijacked toward a larger anti-modernist agenda, whereby a lot of proponents of the more extreme view have really sort of predicted the imminent collapse of modernism, and therefore we should all reject modernism and adopt, you know, local economies and then radically simplify our lifestyle and get urgent all of a sudden. And while some of those ideas sound pretty good, the idea of imminent collapse, I'd say, sort of is not really that evident from an evolutionary perspective. Threats are real and crisis is upon us, but I don't think that we necessarily have to assume that everything's going to be collapsing down no matter what we do. I think that's overstated. Likewise, awakening is happening, you know, enlightenment is occurring, and yet I don't think we need to look to the great awakening throughout humanity as the sort of kind of pseudo-miraculous salvation from our problems, because again, from an evolutionary perspective, that doesn't seem entirely likely, although, you know, I'd certainly love it to happen, and it's not beyond the realm. I just think we need to be more realistic in working to evolve our culture by recognizing what we can do, and that is we can transcend the limitations of postmodernism while including all of the important gains that it has brought us, and recognize that we are standing on its shoulders. You know, we are in this worldview that we're promoting depends on the accomplishments of postmodernism, and indeed showing that can help postmodernists better recognize how their worldview in turn rests upon the ongoing accomplishments of this modernist developed society that is our heritage. But in terms of, you know, waking up to our own conscious ability to evolve, our own conscious ability to make a difference in the world, I think, you know, to sort of loop it back to the sort of the theme, one of the themes of your series here is the future of spiritual practice. Something that Michael Murphy said in his interview was particularly meaningful to me, where he talked about how something is even, like he said, as absurd as golf can produce mystical experiences and transcendent spiritual growth. And part of the way that happens is that anything that people are striving for perfection in, anything that is that inherently they want to get better at and improve, not just for the instrumental purpose of getting better at it for doing what it's good for, but also for it, you know, as a thing in itself. It has both instrumental usefulness and intrinsic worth. Whatever we find in our lives, whether it's golf or meditation or political activism or philosophical reading and writing, I mean, all of these things, where we're really striving to do our best at it and we really care about it, that is a deeply spiritual practice. And when we come to recognize that, that spirit, you know, can be described, defined in many ways, but maybe one description of it that we might get agreement on is that spirit is the presence of the infinite within the finite, and that this sort of the presence of the infinite within the finite, you know, kind of we can recognize it as a kind of existential dynamic quality, the ontological quality of the universe, and this quality isn't just waiting to be, you know, discovered. It's not just like a scientific fact that we can just see. It depends upon the level of our own consciousness. As our consciousness evolves, we come to see value with new clarity, and we come to feel its gravity. This quality, this presence of the infinite, has a gravity. We can sense that there's an ever-widening potential for a better way, and the more we get in touch with that, indeed, that evolutionary impulse, we feel that eros, that value gravity, that can not only motivate us to try to give our gift in better and bigger ways, but it can also guide us. It can instruct us. It can show us. It can be a real descriptive how-to, because when we really get in touch with the value that touches us most directly, the thing which we think is most good or most true or most beautiful, and we pursue that, when we experience and create value, we are participating most directly in the current cutting edge of evolution. You know, we're making the world a better place, because that's how the world gets better, is becoming more good, more valuable, more true, more beautiful. I mean, and that's how evolution has always occurred in culture, and we can begin to see that that's, you know, an overarching theme in evolution as a whole, and begin to see how we're connected to all of evolution. So in terms of spiritual practice, anything that we do, any work that's worth doing, that has intrinsic value in it, is a form of spiritual practice, and coming to see that from an evolutionary, spiritual, philosophical perspective that can help us appreciate that value itself is what is spiritual, I think this can open up a new dimension of human achievement and well-being.
Beautiful. Well, thank you, Steve. I want to keep going, but It's that time, and I'm sure there are many people listening in who would like to join the conversation. So if you're listening via the web, please, this is an invitation to go ahead and type out, try to be fairly concise, in the instant teleseminar window you have, just starting right now, please type that in. And if you are joining us via phone, please, if you'd like to raise your hand, press star 2, and we'll see that you're interested to ask a question. Before we go any further, though, I want to acknowledge the generosity of our wonderful sponsors who enable us to bring this to you free of charge. Maestro Conference is a unique voice-based online collaboration platform that integrates the web and your telephone to support large-scale, real-time, remote conferences, seminars, and interactive events. Using cutting-edge technology that empowers individual awareness and engagement, Maestro Conference offers a whole new way to engage people and create relationships, combining the ease of passive media with the engagement and excitement of live events. Visit them on the web at maestroconference.com. That's M-A-E-S-T-R-O, maestroconference.com. And New Dimensions Media. Check out New Dimensions to hear some of the leading point writers in the world, such as Alice Walker, Dr. Andrew Weil, Gene Houston, who will be with us next Sunday, by the way, Bill Moyers, David White, and many others, as they address a wide range of topics, including health and healing, science, eco-activism, social change, and spirituality. Do it now, and you'll be glad you did. That's New Dimensions Media at newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Also, stay tuned, and at the end of this call, I'll tell you a little more about my upcoming interviews. This week, I'll be doing three of them. I'll be talking with Lama Suryadas just 2 days from now on Tuesday, also at 5 p.m., with Hale Dwoskin of the Sedona Method on Thursday, and with Gene Houston next Sunday, a week from today. Okay. So, let's see. Do we have some questions? Sue in Pittsford asks, it seems that failure to evolve has led to the demise of many civilizations of the past, dating as far back as Sumer, 5,000 years ago. Have you noticed patterns of similarity from age to age that point to the time in which we are now living? In fact, is that what constitutes a new age as humans choose to change based on the appearance of divine teachings like Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, and Baha'u'llah, whose teachings, she must be, maybe she's Baha'i, she says, whose teachings are the most recent in a long line of what he terms as progressive revelation. And this is Sue in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Well, first, let me say that from an integral perspective, we're living at a time in history, but the human race is living at many times in history. The evolution of consciousness and culture has really spread out over the last 5,000 years of history. There are some places in the world where consciousness and culture have changed very little in the last 1,000 years. And there are other places where, it's really exhibiting the most fresh forms of emergence, the human race has ever known. I mean, even here in the United States, there are many people, although they, drive cars and they participate in all the modern systems and technologies of the present age, are still culturally pre-modern in terms of their values and their worldview and their sense of what's true. So I think evolution is occurring on many fronts, and there's, a tendency sometimes to sort of see humanity as one kind of homogenous group with one edge of development. And of course, from an integral perspective, we recognize many edges of development, and we recognize progress along all those fronts of development. I also think it's worth affirming that people have a right to be who they are, that from an integral perspective, we don't think that there's an imperative to evolve, that while there's pressure to evolve because of the worldwide crises that we are facing, and yet people who live in pre-modern societies are not inherently less valuable, from a spiritual perspective than people who live in postmodern cultural contexts. And so that's part of this dialectical perspective that I touched on earlier, and that we've got to recognize that there is a dimension of vertical development in which evolution does create new and expanded levels of value. And we also have to recognize that everybody deserves respect, and that every worldview is, in a sense, appropriate for its given set of life conditions that it encounters along the historical timeline in which it first arose, and where those conditions continue to exist. That worldview is probably the most effective at dealing with those conditions, right? So it's complex, and yet I think that we needn't throw up our hands when we look at the evolutionary spectrum of development. I think we can recognize that there are new opportunities, and the people who are listening to this series and who are participating in trying to become agents of evolution by discerning what evolution is and where it's heading, and how they can position themselves to participate in this latest emergence. There sure is a lot of parallels with history. I mean, Mark Twain is famous for saying that history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And so we see history recapitulating. I mean, the modernism emerged through a new kind of philosophy that led to a new worldview in the Enlightenment. And we can see that this evolutionary worldview is emerging similarly with a new kind of philosophy. And in some ways, it's a higher harmonic of modernism. And I've argued that it has the potential to be, in a sense, a kind of second Enlightenment. But, it could be decades before the evolutionary worldview really begins to have any significant social structures or institutions attached to it. All we can do is, be loyal tadpoles as we are waiting to become frogs. And, I think resist the temptation to hark to the voices of those who would say that, that our doom is inevitable and that our collapse is imminent, because I don't think that evolution necessarily points to that.
Well, good. I'm all for hope, as everybody who's kind of tuning into my stuff is well aware. There's one more question from the Instant Teleseminar window. It's kind of interesting. This is Josefina Lorenzo from Neuquén. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this even vaguely right. Neuquén, maybe. Thank you, from Argentina, believe it or not. Everything you say enlightens and gives so much clarity and hope to a Latin American woman of 56 that I literally fell on my knees as an expression of gratefulness and love. Oh.
Wow.
Perhaps
well, all
I'm more integral
creator
than I thought already. God bless you. Okay,
yeah,
well, that's
God
not a question so much, but that's nice to hear. Thank you, Josefina.
Yeah. All credit to the creator, Josefina.
Absolutely. We have a question on the phone lines, a live question from Del Mar, California. Aconia, please, you're on the air. What's your name? Hello? You have a Del Mar, California 858 phone number. You're live.
Can you hear me right now?
Yes.
Oh, thank you for picking up my call. I was curious actually about the speaker's conception of the postmodern understandings behind sort of the theories of things like simulacra and hyperreality, and how self-reflexivity plays such a significant part in postmodernism. And I know those are pretty technical terms, but my understanding of postmodernism is maybe a bit different, or maybe it just needs to be like sort of enlightened upon by you to see what is the difference between what's happened since the time at which Baudrillard and all these other postmodernist philosophers were talking about these very removed, obscure, egotistical perspectives relative to today.
Well, first let me remind us that postmodernism, in the parlance of this evolutionary perspective, is a defined term. And it's a problematic one, but it's one that has the most cachet in terms of agreement, and it's also the most conveniently descriptive. It does describe this worldview as being beyond modernism or postmodernism. Of course, that term is easily conflated to be associated with deconstructionist philosophy of the version as advanced by Foucault or Derrida, and and other French, you know, deconstructionists. And while I would say that was part of postmodernism, I don't think that form of postmodern philosophy had any, it was anywhere near as significant to the formation of this countercultural worldview we're describing as was Enlightenment philosophy to the emergence of modernism, right? I mean, there is a versions of postmodern philosophy, but you know, the French deconstructionists, I'd say, you know, played an only a minor role. So that's part of the problem, is when we talk about postmodernism, people are habituated into thinking about it in terms of that more narrow meaning. And while the deconstructionists were certainly anti-modern, and they certainly had a perspective that transcended modernism and pushed off against its pathologies, I'd say that the way the culture exists today, those of us who kind of are more familiar with the more progressive segments of the developed world, can recognize the rough outlines of postmodern culture as being characterized, you know, more by the environmental movement, by progressive forms of spirituality, by alternative lifestyles, by a sensitive, pluralistic kind of leftist politics, and these, you know, the distinct contributions of these earlier philosophers, while part of the mix, you know, is not very definitive. So, you know, I mean, we could get into the more technical aspects, but, you know, hopefully that answer will suffice.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And, you know, I didn't hear your name clearly. What is it?
Oh, my name is Tiffany Thompson, and I'm in Santa Barbara, which is why I didn't pick up.
I see. Okay. Well,
Del Mar.
For some reason, it identified you as being from Del Mar. I'm not sure. Thank you so much, Tiffany. Okay, we have another question here from Toronto, Ontario, from Carolyn Winter. You're live.
Oh, hi. I'm so glad you took my call. I'm really enjoying this series. And, Steve, your talk was really inspiring. But I do have a question I'd love to hear your perspective on. I really hold out hope that things aren't collapsing and that, you know, consciousness and evolution is really moving along, I think, faster than we realize. And I'm wondering if you can comment on the role that the Internet is playing on forcing consciousness everywhere. Like to me, when I just take a look at what's happening in every sector, it's like the groups of people all over, like this group, we couldn't have talked like this even 5 years ago. We'd have never been connected. I wouldn't have been plugged in. But now the Internet just plugs so many groups around the world to talk, and it's even forcing, like, large companies to listen to people. Like, the big thing now is not to advertise, it's to engage and relate and to build relationships with people. And to me, those are, like, cornerstones for advancing consciousness. And I kind of wonder if the Internet isn't forcing this grand next evolutionary step. I wonder what you thought about that.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. Let me say first that, you know, the Internet certainly has been a significant catalyst to the evolution of civilization. And like all forms of evolution, you know, it has progress and pathology, right? Not only has the Internet facilitated, you know, the rise of grassroots culture and disempowered modernism, which once used to kind of control all media through the sort of corporate filters. Now media has been democratized in many important ways through the Internet, and this is a tremendous benefit. It makes culture more liquid. It makes it more able to evolve at a faster pace and on many more fronts than it would have earlier. But, of course, the Internet has also empowered you know, many dark elements of our culture. It's empowered, you know, Al-Qaeda. It's empowered pornography. It's empowered, you know, hate groups. And it's allowed, you know, dark elements of our culture to find ways to organize and recruit, which has promoted their development in ways that's hurt us all. So I would say that the Internet is a powerful tool. It's a powerful tool for good and bad. I think that in terms of its relation to, you know, the larger state of evolution of the culture of the world, I would say that one of the things about the integral perspective is that it recognizes that the inside and the outside evolve together. And sometimes there'll be a breakthrough on the inside, new ideals or new ideas, and those will eventually manifest on the outside in powerful ways. Sometimes there'll be a breakthrough technologically, and that'll a development on the external side of things will then catalyze development on the inside. So I would say that the internet is an important development of the information economy of computer technology, and these are this breakthrough in technological evolution is one of the natural outgrowths of modernism, right? The scientific technology comes from modernism, more or less.
Right.
And as modernism has globalized and become more refined and developed, it's brought us more and more amazing scientific technologies, the internet being, particularly significant emergence within that larger course. And, of course, not just modernism, but postmodernism and all kinds of pre-modern cultures have now making use of this technology, and that technology itself is raising consciousness to a degree, but it's also being used to empower the forces which would take us backward in evolution. So, I think the internet's a good thing. I think that it is a it represents an important step in the flowering of the noosphere. Right, many people sort of claim that Teilhard de Chardin's conception of the noosphere was in many ways a prediction or a prescient a kind of a prophecy of the coming of the internet. And so the internet itself is a kind of an external technological piece of evidence which is naturally coming along with the larger and larger globalization and interconnection of the culture. But like any piece of technology, it can be turned against us if we're not careful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That was good.
Sure. Thank you for a good question.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Carolyn.
All right.
Okay. We have a question here from Joe in Redmond, Washington. What is the definition of an evolutionary leader? What's the structure, purpose, and direction of the evolutionary leaders group that you're a part of?
Okay, thanks for that question. The evolutionary leaders, it's a problematic term because everyone engaged in the evolutionary worldview is really a leader, and I think one of the goals of this group is to bring about the evolution of consciousness and culture. Conscious evolution is one of the bywords of this group. So, it's certainly not without some consideration that I allow that name, evolutionary leader, to be applied to me, because I am a part of that group. I don't think I would have chosen that title for the group if it had been up to me. That's a group. It's a group of about 50 writers and thinkers and luminaries that have been invited to gather in a yearly workshop in California. It was spearheaded by Deepak Chopra, and it has as its more prominent members many of the luminaries of postmodern culture. And many of these people are kind of in transition from a postmodern kind of new age progressive spiritual perspective into a more evolutionary perspective. So this group contains both postmodernists and integralists, and I know that I became a part of it because I wanted to try to have a small influence on some of these thinkers who have large audiences, such as Marianne Williamson or Deepak Chopra. And to bring an integral perspective, many of these people have heard of this integral worldview, but never really seen it in action or don't appreciate, the differences and even some of the antithetical elements between postmodernism and this evolutionary worldview. So the Evolutionary Leaders Group is a kind of a very loosely organized group of people who just come together as kind of a club of people who want to meet and greet and exchange ideas, and whether this group bears significant spiritual fruit or not, I'm not sure. So I'm cautious but optimistic, and I'll continue to participate and support their efforts. And I think in the distinct answer to your question, an evolutionary leader is anybody who is actively trying to be an agent of evolution for the good.
Okay, great. Thanks, Steve. We have a question in the instant teleseminar window from Ralph in Perth, Australia, that kind of follows that up. He says, Steve, this is wonderful. Practical, everyday spirituality. Do what you love to do and thus take personal responsibility for your life. But is not evolution happening in a way despite whatever we may or may not do?
Oh, great question. That's really great. Well, I would say that the phase of evolution that is the leading edge of development now, that is the evolution of human consciousness and culture, is directly participatory. In other words, the culture doesn't evolve by itself. It's not automatic. It's not a machine. Human culture is the collective efforts of everybody who participates in that culture to make their lives better, right? That is, when we try to improve our conditions and we try to help others, when we work toward the improvement of the human condition in large and small ways, we are causing evolution to occur, right? And what makes it authentic evolution is when conditions are improved, right? Like, we don't need a definitive pole star or a well-defined omega point by which to judge progress. We can simply ask, has suffering been lessened? Are people more free? And if where that's the case, we can say that the human condition has been improved. But this improvement occurs through human action, human effort, human achievement and accomplishment. And where people don't try to improve their conditions rarely improve. So I would say that at this phase in evolution, it's not automatic. It's not just random. It's not some so larger, mysterious teleological force that's just moving us no matter what we do. It's not a conveyor belt. It's up to us. We are the agents of evolution. And if we're going to achieve evolution, we have to actually act and try to make things better. And, we also have to be mindful of the fact that no matter how much we try to make things better, we're going to create new problems that then can only be solved by further improvements. So that ever-present dialectic of progress and pathology is just part of the system. And so when we come to understand evolution from this deeper level, we don't get frustrated with it or try to level it all or try to claim that nobody can say anything's more evolved than anything else as a remedy to past pathologies, because that cuts off our key ability to try to deal with those pathologies. So I would say that evolution doesn't happen automatically, not the evolution of consciousness and culture, and that's why we have to participate. Indeed, our participation is a key element that's built into the system and helps to explain its overall purpose in a cosmic sense.
Beautiful. Thank you, Steve. We have a caller from a phone number with a Colorado area code. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. Who is this?
This is David.
Welcome.
Thank you. I have a question for Steve. We haven't talked about integral very much tonight, but in looking at first tier versus second tier and integral, it strikes me that the creation of a second tier being significantly different from a first tier. In other words, why isn't integral just merely another level of the first tier? And something that's not been written much or talked about, it seems to me that an aspect of second tier, which does not exist in first tier, if this is true, would be that integral would be accepting the belief that we create and are responsible for our own reality. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, sure, of course. Thank you for that. That's a kind of a juicy entree. Because first let me comment about first tier and second tier. That we could probably trace back to Maslow, who kind of conceived of two levels in his hierarchy of needs, the sort of the level at which you're trying to overcome deficiencies. And then he described this level of self-actualization, wherein our values are not driven by deficiency as they are by being. He called them being needs. And that was taken over by Claire Graves, who was a direct sort of descendant of Maslow's work, who was the researcher behind the spiral dynamics work. And so this idea of first tier and second tier was actually coined by Chris Cowan, one of the co-authors of Spiral Dynamics, to characterize this underlying Maslowian conception of self-actualization moving from deficiency into being. However, I kind of resist the characterization of first tier and second tier, and I don't use those in my book or really in any of my teaching, because A, first tier and second tier sounds like we're second rate from one perspective, and from another perspective, it's extremely arrogant, you know, to sort of describe the idea that there's all these first tier people and we've now, you know, we're in a whole new tier. And while I think that there are certainly arguments that can be made that says that because this evolutionary perspective or the integral worldview can kind of assimilate and integrate all the levels in a way that none of the previous levels can do, then there is a kind of a breakthrough of a new capacity. But you can recognize new capacities and evolutionary breakthroughs in the emergence of every one of these historically significant worldviews we've been talking about. So I'm not, you know, extremely keen on the idea of this rigid, you know, division between first tier and second tier. And while I can see some validity to it, I don't advocate it, and I don't like it. Regarding creating our own reality, I think that, you know, we've got to be careful there. I mean, at one level, certainly, we create our own reality, and there's a deep truth to that. And awakening to the constructivist nature of reality was an important postmodern insight. You know, the way at which, you know, some of the insights from Est, you know, which became the forum about creating our own reality and being responsible for our own experience, you know, these have been positive developments within the postmodern perspective. But like any truth, if you take it too far and you take it to its extreme, you can bring out latent pathologies that are within it. So the idea that you completely create your own reality, like The Secret, right? Like that you can just sort of visualize a parking space and it appears, or that, you know, any trivial thing can be just created by your want or your whim, I think is a distortion. I mean, this world is full of trouble and suffering, and we can't just create our reality in a way that eliminates that. We live in this world, we're born into it, and we have a responsibility to try to help improve the human condition. And so while we might have a big influence on how our personal reality is perceived or viewed or created, this create your own reality idea, you can't take it all the way, because then it becomes, I think, a falsehood. So I could say more, but I don't want to be too negative, so let's leave it at that.
Thank you so much for your question.
Thank you.
We have a couple of interesting questions. Oh, gosh, and a couple more people's hands up, and we're getting close to the end of our time. Well, here's one that I really want to make sure to ask. Bill from Oakland, California asks, when talking to the scientific community, what are the openings for widening the conversation about evolution beyond the confines of the modern scientific worldview? How do you get scientists to even consider that their paradigm might not be as all-inclusive as they think?
Well, thank you for that excellent question. I mean, that's the whole focus of this book, Evolution's Purpose, which I'm, you know, just completing now. It's actually, unlike Integral Consciousness, my previous book, which was really written for, you know, a postmodern integral community of people who are already interested in these ideas, Evolution's Purpose is trying to argue without any prior assumptions of about progressive spirituality. It's aimed at modernists. It's aimed at the scientific establishment. And while fundamentalists such as Richard Dawkins, you know, they're never going to move off. There's no argument. The worldviews are somewhat incommensurable that way. There's no fact or there's no argument that's going to change their identity because they're so embedded in it. There are many open-minded scientists who I think will be persuaded as these just recently emerging new perspectives on evolution come to light. So, for example, Stuart Kaufman's book, Reinventing the Sacred, which came out in 2008, and which I mentioned earlier in the talk, where he really shows how agency, this idea of purpose within life, is an emergent entity. And you know, it can't be detected with scientific instruments, and yet it's as plain as the nose on our face. I mean, we have a direct experience of it, and we can see it in every life form, and we can see how this purpose quickens within life as it evolves, and how the ability to recognize values is something that can be traced along with this chain of emergences that characterizes the progressive side of evolution. And so part of it is the philosophical arguments that are just becoming available today and which are just being made, by certain people within the integral community. And I think many who are might have a center of gravity within modernism or postmodernism, people like Stuart Kaufman, who are nevertheless recognizing that a reductionistic, positivistic, materialistic worldview is now outmoded and worn out. So this is really the current cutting edge, and there's important work to be done, but this book that I've just completed hopefully will make a difference in really bringing out some of the arguments that show how these characterizations of evolution as though it were kind of an accident or otherwise meaningless are just as outmoded as a worldview that sees the world was created in 6 days, right? It's just equally mythological.
I think that's something worth unpacking a little more. So why is that mythological? Is it because we essentially do not know and can't explain this emergence of value and of development that there, if there is no nothing but randomness active in this process, then the emergence of life and consciousness and culture and goodness and truth and beauty would not be flowering so directly?
Well, when we frame evolution in a way that allows us to appreciate how it does in fact generate value and how the creatures of evolution themselves are increasingly recruited to the task of discerning this value and responding to it, when we see how there is an authentic form of value gravity that is an essential part of the evolutionary process, both in life and in consciousness and culture, how all of life is striving for survival value. They're all trying to survive and reproduce. And this is an evident form of evolutionary reality that's plain, but which is completely breaks out of the materialistic perspective, because value is inherently metaphysical. It's inherently extra-physical. And when we then begin to recognize that human consciousness itself is evolving and that this evolution has a relative continuity with other earlier forms of evolution, and we begin to see that human evolution occurs through the efforts of or the action of free will. In other words, free will in humans is highly metaphysical. Many scientific materialists have attempted to deny that the will is free and that everything is determined. But I think most sensible people have a direct experience of the freedom of their will and recognize how teachings that deny free will are pernicious, because they deny the very possibility of spiritual growth and goodness. Right? You can't have goodness or morality without freedom. It's it's not possible. And therefore, if we're going to have a conception of the good, and we're going to recognize that our society has been evolving to the good for the last at least 40,000 years. Then we can recognize that values do have a role to play in evolution, and we can see that a purely materialistic account is completely inadequate based on this very truth.
Wow. Thank you so much, Steve. That was a very eloquent way to bring this aspect to a close. This has been very rich. Before I tell you about what's coming up next, and before we open up the line so that those of us on the phone can hear each other's voice and everybody on the webcast can hear our voices, a few reminders. If you're interested to dive deeper into this conversation, be sure and visit our blog. It's a place where I periodically post blogs, and I recently posted one this past week that's gotten a lot of comments and attention, called Finding Your Yes. So please check that out at Terry's Corner at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. And you can also join our Facebook group at beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook, where you can discuss all these topics. And you can also post comments about our dialogue today and maybe questions for Tuesday's dialogue with Lama Suryadas, or Thursday's dialogue with Hale Dwoskin, or next Sunday's dialogue with Jean Houston. And if you or anybody you know might be interested to participate in this series and you're not already registered, please go to beyondawakeningseries.com, or you can forward your friends one of our emails so that they can participate too. If any of you are interested to learn about me and my own work, my website is integralspiritualpractice.com. That's integralspiritualpractice.com. And if you sign up there, you'll get a free guided meditation that I offer. I also want to thank some of the partners and sponsors who've made all of this possible. Ray Lynch Productions, a number of you have asked us about the hold music that we play just before the call begins. It's a piece titled Only an Enjoyment from the album by Ray Lynch entitled Nothing Above My Shoulders But the Evening Sky. His album Deep Breakfast went platinum without him even performing or touring at all. Just based on the haunting depth and uplifting beauty of some of the sounds. His conscious music offers timeless beauty that doesn't grow old, and you can purchase it at raylynch.com or via iTunes. That's raylynch.com. And The Voice for Love. If you've ever wanted to learn how to hear the voice of God within you as a distinct and conversational voice to receive comfort, understanding, healing, and divine guidance in every area of your life, visit thevoiceforlove.com. David Paul and Candace Doyle, the founders, have taught tens of thousands of people over the past 15 years how to hear God's voice within them. And whether you call it higher self, Holy Spirit, Source, God, or true self, they will share with you their five-step process for experiencing the divine within you as a distinct and conversational voice at thevoiceforlove.com. And remember, please tune in 2 days on Tuesday, November 16th at 5 p.m. Pacific. I'll be speaking with Lama Suryadas, the first Westerner to become a fully empowered Lama in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, on a spirituality that creates the future. We'll be asking questions like, how does our spirituality express itself in what we're leaving behind for our children, grandchildren, and other future generations? He'll be addressing our relationship to time and the busy pace of 21st century life, introducing his unique down-to-earth humor and perspective, including what he calls Buddha Standard Time. And then on Thursday, November 18th, at this same time, I'll be speaking with Hale Dwoskin, the author of The Sedona Method. And next Sunday, November 21st, also at 5 p.m. Pacific, I'll be talking with the researcher, visionary, and force of nature named Dr. Gene Houston. So thank you so much for joining me and Steve tonight. And let's open up our phone lines so that those on the phone at least can hear each other's voices, and we can all hear that and say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Thank
you for joining us. Thank you
very much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay. Well.